Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
This episode is amazing, and it starts off hot out of the gates.
Yeah, we must have chatted for a couple of minutes before we started recording, because, or we just came on straight. It's hard for me to remember. We come straight out of the gate, like, with the ice broken, but we continue to break it even more. So it's a fun interview.
So we are excited to introduce you to our fellow survivor and friend, Marley Liss. Marley and I connected on Instagram first, actually, and just had kind of been following each other. But our backgrounds are both a lot of pink and sparkles and things. I'm like, this is somebody that I feel like I would get along with very well. And then there's Taylor Swift quotes and all of the things came together. And I'm like, as soon as we met, I'm like, you need to meet Kara, too. And then we did. And we recorded it. And it's here for everyone to enjoy.
One of the things I forgot is she says at the end of the episode that she feels like she's a combination of the two of us. Like, she could be our child. So Marley is unofficially our love child.
Our platonic love child.
Yes. Yes. Which you'll see what we mean whenever you listen to this episode.
A little bit about Marley. She is a somatic educator, social worker, and sparkle-loving lesbian Jewish feminist. Quote unquote. That is literally what she had.
That is her own bio.
I love it so much.
Yeah.
She made history in the justice system when her sexual assault case became the first in North America to conclude with restorative justice through the courts.
You're going to learn a lot more about what restorative justice is exactly. This may be a new idea to you, but she's the perfect person to teach you about this because she was the first case in North America. Since then, she supported thousands in learning trauma-informed pleasure and inclusive consent education. Her work has been featured in Forbes, Huffington Post, BuzzFeed, and The Mel Robbins Show, and just so many more places.
She's an award-winning speaker for all the reasons you're about to figure out. She's delivered talks for the National Sexual Assault Conference, Vanderbilt University, Action Trauma Summit, like all of these different things. You name it, she spoke there. She was one of 25 survivors on an elite panel for the National Action Plan to End Gender-Based Violence, informing federal policy. And her story is currently being made into a documentary directed by Kelsey Dara.
So we hope that you love listening to this interview with Marley as much as we love the conversation. Here it is.
Hi, Marley.
Hi. I also have a bit of a dumb. I look like a little baby in the screenshot picture. Like, I look like I'm like.
I got my hair done this morning and sent Kara a picture. And she's like, you look like that meme of the little girl in the car that's like, with her teeth out. You would sit down in the salon chair and there is never a more humbling experience than that moment where you're like, this is what I have. This is it.
Yep. That's what I'm bringing to the table.
Oh, yikes. Okay. Hi. Anyway, I'm really excited that you're here.
I'm excited.
This is exciting for me too, because Marley and Kara finally get to meet. Long overdue.
Yay. I'm happy we're meeting.
So I am going to start us off with our icebreaker question that we always ask everyone. And that is, what's your current binge? Whether it is podcast, TV show, book series, like what is it that you are consuming and can't get enough of?
Love that. I was really late to the game in discovering Bridgerton, and it took me a while to get into. But then I was going to London this past month, and I was like, if I'm going to England, this is the time to get into Bridgerton. So I got like really obsessed, and my girlfriend and I have a running joke that my dog is secretly Lady Whistledown. So that's like my lore.
I love it. But is there anything better than coming late to a show when you're like, oh my God, I have so much of it to watch?
Yes. And I'm like, and then people are like, and you have the Queen Charlotte like spinoff or whatever as well. So we have abundance for sure.
So much so. It's like that feeling. Are you a reader, Marley?
Yes, I'm a reader.
You know the feeling when you start a book and it's like a series and you're like, this is a 7-book series. It never is going to end. Or like you get a book and you're like, it's so big. I have so much reading to do.
Like, that's a good perspective, because I feel that sometimes I feel the opposite. I'm like, this is daunting. I have so much reading to do, but I like this reframe.
Oh, I love it. Like, okay, well, it depends on the book. Like The Body Keeps the Score, for instance, I opened it and I was like, these words are so small and they go so, like, the margins are so little. Sure. So, yeah. But then it's like, you know, Gone with the Wind. And I'm like, there's so many words. I love it so much.
I like that.
When it's a series that, you know, a bunch of people are obsessed with too, then I'm like, oh, thank goodness there's 4, 5, 6 books. Have you gleefully bound towards the cult that is A Court of Thorns and Roses, Sarah J. Maas universe?
I did. You know what? I read the first 3 like years ago, and then I paused for like too long. And then now I'm like, if I were to read them again, I'd have to start over because I just don't remember anything. But it could happen for sure.
I personally think the elite Sarah J. Maas series is Throne of Glass. I think it's the best. Kim is a Crescent City girly.
I did love Crescent
City. But I feel like A Court of Throne and I can never say it. A Court of
Akatar.
What? Akatar. What? Yes. I feel like that's like the entry into Sarah J. Maas. And so, but they're very good.
Okay. Good to know. I'm also like writing my book right now. So I'm kind of like trying to, if I'm engaging in a book, I should be working on mine.
Fair enough.
Do you find that when you are reading something at the same time as writing, that you sort of take on some of those traits of the other author's writing style? Because I'm wondering if this is a universal experience.
100%, because you know how I was like Bridgerton. I was like, I have to pause Bridgerton because I'm writing like
Lady Whistledown.
Yeah, like I was like, there's Rita,
the gentle survivor.
I was like, I have to stop because I sound like a medieval soon to be wedded off bride, and it's not exactly the vibe I'm going for.
Let me just tell you, I have been writing since before we even went to court, so way back when. And there is some writing that I read Twilight at the same time, and there is nothing more cringe than making your story almost sound like fan fiction, and I'm like horrified reading it. Like, these are good pieces to pick out, but now I should burn this because, dear sweet baby Jesus, no one needs to see this. It never needs to get
God bless. I can only imagine. I would like to read that someday.
No.
You haven't read Twilight?
No, I've read Twilight. I mean,
Cam's book. Okay, Cam's fanfic.
Horny Mormon vampire.
Got it. It sounds good. It sounds like a good fusion, like a court story with a bit of vampire.
It was some sewer posting, let's be real.
I think we have sufficiently broken all of the ice. So, Marley, tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, how you came to be sitting here today, to your comfort level.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely do like a long version and a short version, but I guess I can do a medium version. So,
all you, your turn, what you're comfortable with.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll start with just like who I am. So yeah, I'm Marley. I'm based in Canada. I have a little baby puppy who's my son. I'm a Sagittarius. I have a background in social work and also somatic sex education, but definitely, and I feel like this is true with y'all as well, what brings me to this work and this seat and this advocacy this the most is like lived experience. And I'm sure we'll get into it deeper, but for my experience of like restorative justice after sexual violence, which is what I talk about so much now, I really didn't even know it existed until I like desperately needed it and was in the justice process for already 3 years. It was definitely like a whole journey where I was doing my degree in social work. I ended up experiencing sexual violence from a stranger. And it was one of those things where he started off really like kind and courteous and then did this very like 180 flip switch and became very violent and just proceeded to assault me for several hours. When I got out of that situation, I went to the hospital. I kind of did everything that literally Google told me to do. Like, I was like, what do you do after you're raped? And it was like, go to the hospital, get a rape kit. So I kind of went through those motions. And eventually the nurse was like, okay, you can either report now or you can just go home. And I was like, I can't fathom doing nothing at all and proceeding with my day with normalcy. Like, what am I going to do? Watch Netflix? So I was like, okay, sure, I guess I'll report. And I really didn't know what I was getting myself into. And so I ended up going through the court process for about 3 years. And it was just so re-traumatizing, so dehumanizing. Like every step I was taking in my healing, I felt like I got sent right back to where I was immediately after rape. And so by the time I was subpoenaed for the criminal trial, I was like, I don't want to do this. And in Canada, we have the option to drop the charges. So I was like, I just want to drop the charges. I don't want to do this. And at the same time, I felt such grief and devastation that I dragged myself through this whole process for nothing. And I had this kind of like fiery friend be like, you know, if anything was possible, what would you actually want? And that's when I basically named restorative justice without having the name for it. So I was like, I want to ask him the questions that have been keeping me up at night for years. I'd want to hear an apology. I'd want him to actually change and never do this to someone again. I want to show up in an authentic way and not have to be a curated version of myself like I did in the courtroom. And my friend was like, so make it happen. I was like, okay. So I started doing all kinds of research, and this is when I found restorative justice. And I was like, holy crap, this thing that I really want is a thing. It has a process and a lineage and it's been done. I was like grateful for that, but also really frustrated that no one had ever told me about options beyond court. So I started fighting for that outcome, and I ended up calling a meeting with the prosecutors and essentially convincing a prosecutor to send my rapist to therapy instead of trial. And so we went to therapy for 7 months, and we eventually met in a restorative circle. And it was the first time in North America that a prosecutor agreed to that outcome. So it had been done outside the system, but not through it for sexual violence. I was just like immensely grateful for that, because it wouldn't have happened if one prosecutor hadn't turned to me and said, like, what you need matters and we should act accordingly. So it was huge. And he ended up going to therapy for 7 months, which is what I wanted. And he did deep work of unpacking everything that led him to justify this degree of violence. And of course, perpetrators are as much a monolith as victims are, meaning they're not a monolith. So that wouldn't work for everyone. But in my case, it did. We eventually ended up meeting in a circle process, and it really blew my mind in terms of how healing it was. Like, it was pretty freaking huge. And I left the circle feeling like happy and like I had let go of like 300 pounds of trauma. And I didn't know you could feel that way after sexual violence. Like, I had never seen that representation. I had never known that was possible. And so that's kind of what made me be loud about my experience, was the contrast of how I felt after court versus how I felt after the circle. And so I went to the media, I shared my story, several articles came out on the same day, Forbes, HuffPost, BuzzFeed. And I started hearing from thousands and thousands of survivors, and I still hear from thousands of survivors literally all over the world. And the main theme was like, I wish I knew about this. People saying like, I didn't go to the police because I didn't feel safe doing that. I wish I knew about this. Or I went to court for years and it tore my family apart. I wish I knew about this. And that really became the fire for me in sharing this story. And this advocacy is like all of those survivors who have a right to know about their options and who have a right to feel like their needs really, really matter, even if they don't fit the mold of the current criminal legal system. So since then, I've been doing speaking and advocating and visiting campuses and training judges and lawyers and prosecutors and nurses and all kinds of people. And it's been incredible in a lot of ways to turn a shitstorm into impact and connection. So that's kind of the medium version of what brings me to this work.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. Every time I hear this or I read it or I see it on your social, it's just seeing where you are now
as opposed to knowing that broken place of not knowing where to go and what to do next. It's really inspiring. I had told Marley ahead of time for our listeners that I was going to interject and let you know that when she and I first connected on social media, I was like, ooh, there's a lot of pink and you're a survivor and I love it. And I started looking through and I was like, oh, what the? Restorative justice for a sex offender. So I actually studied restorative justice and victim offender dialogue throughout the course of my undergrad and grad programs. And it's fantastic. It is really, really great, but not for sexual violence. And that's what I always thought. That was what was hammered into my head. It can't be done for sexual offenders because it's a different feeling. So the ones that I've seen really work are ones where like there's restitution or property damage, or maybe it was something that had to do with even harassment. But when you came to those domestic violence, sexual violence cases, it was absolutely not. So my viewpoint was very black and white. And then through the course of talking with Marley, and we hopped on a Zoom and it went way, way longer than we had anticipated, which was fabulous. But immediately I was like, I cannot wait to introduce you to Kara and all the other people I know. And just you're with us now, whether you like it or not. But Marley challenged my viewpoints on restorative justice. And even for someone who has been in victim advocacy for as long as I have or Kara has, it's important to have the victim, the survivor, at the center of what needs to be done. I loved some of the things that you pointed out along the way while you're sharing your story. So he went to therapy for a long time. This isn't just, I don't want to go to court, but I can get in a room with him. There is so much prep work and things that go into it before you get to that circle. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, well, I totally get the resistance. I also think part of what people imagine is another adversarial cookie cutter, one size fits all approach to justice, which is never what I'm advocating for. The main message I try to get across is there's no one size fits all when it comes to justice. And that exactly, like you said, the importance of turning towards a survivor in a moment of crisis and saying, what do you need? And then shaping a justice process around that is such an act of care, of consent, of affirming agency, of giving a survivor a sense of power and like a real experience of power as well after something so powerless. So truly, like the moment I got a call saying, this prosecutor heard you, she's fighting for this outcome, we're going to try to make this happen. That in and of itself was so healing because I was like, wow, look at this time. I'm saying my no, I'm saying my yes, and it's actually having some kind of gravity over the situation. Whereas we know in trauma, that's not the case. It's like our voices don't matter. So that's such a huge piece of it. So my prep looked like him going to therapy because that's what was meaningful to me. But there can be a million different versions of restorative justice based on what's meaningful to the survivor and based on what's accessible. So maybe someone else would be like, I want him to do volunteer work related to this for a full year. There's a story of a woman who was riding the bus and she was physically assaulted. And she was like, what would be meaningful to me is if this guy rode the same bus every day and wrote a reflective letter on what it must have felt like to be assaulted on the bus for a year. So he wrote like 365 letters and she was like, that was meaningful to me. That was justice to me. So I think a part of the core of restorative justice is that there's a wraparound approach. There's a before, a during, and an after. Like you're saying, we're not just crossing our fingers, throwing a victim and perpetrator in a room and hoping for the best. Like I think that's the illusion a lot of the time of restorative justice, but it's so much more than that. There's a before, a during, and an after, and what that looks like depends on what the survivor actually needs.
One of the things that you had said to me previously was about how the man who assaulted you had kind of changed his mind and switched gears, because it has to be both parties that are willing to engage. And don't forget, the biggest piece is accountability. If you are not willing to take accountability, restorative justice doesn't work, period. most justice really won't work. And when you look at our traditional justice system, whether that is American, Canadian, overseas, wherever that might be, that accountability piece is the biggest indicator for changes in behavior. But talk about his change of heart and what that looked like.
Yeah. So something my assailant shared in the circle was that, like, when he was first charged, he really minimized what happened. And he explained that, like, it was so out of line with how he saw himself in the world, the kind of son he is, the kind of friend he has. He just couldn't face it. Like, he, like, shoved it down. He was like, no, this didn't happen, which pissed me off to hear. Like, I was like, that's so infuriating. And it wasn't until a community member, so like another woman in his life that he kind of saw as a sister, came to him and she was like, I was sexually assaulted. And she talked about how she was assaulted by someone else. He felt heartbreak around that because this person was like a sister to him. And something about him feeling that empathy for a survivor, he described it as, in that moment, all of his memories of the night unlocked and he could no longer suppress what he had done. And at that point, he was so overwhelmed with shame and remorse that he was actually considering taking his life. And this is around the same point that I'm considering taking my life, right? That's kind of a parallel reality to me. And I thought of that when we're sitting in a circle, like, wow, the parallel reality to this is neither of us are here. But it was one of those things where, like, I needed the restorative process so deeply because it was reflective of what I needed. But he also needed the process so deeply because, in a way, he needed to take accountability in order to be okay. And I think that's representation that we don't really see a lot. There's obviously a lot of cases where the perpetrator won't take accountability. Like, they just won't get there. And you're right, Kim, like, they have to be consenting and taking accountability to do a process like this. But there is a lot of cases where if community support's there, if professional support's there, if safe conditions for accountability are created, and by that I mean like a confidentiality agreement, something like that, that doesn't interfere with their access to housing and employment and stigma and all these things, then they might take accountability and they might actually have a need for it. And obviously it's like, this is one of the most high stakes examples that we're talking about sexual violence. But if we think of something lower stakes, like times where we've fucked over a friend or just acted shitty, sometimes we do have that deep need of like, I really need to talk to them. I really need to just like right this wrong. I need to do what I can, right? So if 1 in 16 men are rapists, then there's going to be a lot of people who are in that position if it's safe enough.
I think it's so interesting because this is not something that I've ever come across, this practice of restorative justice, because like you said, it's not something that's done through the court systems here in the United States in general. And so obviously I was stolen any sort of justice from my situation. But some of the things that it kind of came up for me while you were talking is, first I was thinking about these ideas of like, maybe someone who stole something or any other crime with which we would see restorative justice, those things kind of come first, I feel like, if that makes sense. So it's like peeling back the onion. When you have someone who perpetrates sexual violence against someone, they don't do that out of the blue, right? They don't do that in a bubble. They don't do that without other things having happened. This is like totally new to me. So I'm literally processing this as you're talking. And so I can just see how this could be such a healing thing. Obviously, you're saying it's healing for victims, and I can see that, but I can see how it's just healing for other people, because I 100% believe that the person who perpetrates violence, they have to take accountability, obviously, and they are the one who made that decision. But in a lot of ways, people that make that decision are victims in some way, shape, or form at some point in their life. And so It's just, jail doesn't heal people. Like, people don't come out of jail healed. They often come out of jail with more criminal information and education. So I just think it's such an interesting concept. And I'm just sitting over here. Kim's like, you can ask a question next. I'm like, I don't know if I have any. I'm just like, I'm like that meme from what is with the woman doing the mathematics in her head. What movie is that?
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful Mind? Is that what it is?
Oh, I always think of Zach Galifianakis and The Hangover when all of them, but that's a parody. I think it's like a Homeland something. I don't know. We're going to find out, but not right now.
I know what you're talking about.
I'm just like, so many things going through my head.
Well, can I add some context as well? The criminal justice system, as we know it today, it is very similar in America, in Canada, and that's because it really was introduced by the British. Like, right? It's like, if then we go to England and it's like, this is kind of what they've been doing for a long time with their sort of like judge outfits and gavels. Like, it's this old school thing that kind of came with colonialism. Prior to that, Indigenous people and like all kinds of different cultures had their own way of navigating justice that didn't look like this one version of justice that's kind of been the like one legitimized version. It's the only one we see if we watch Netflix. It's the only one we read about. So I think that taking a step back and being like, oh yeah, we know that survivors, like I said before, are not a monolith. We're all so different. And same thing for perpetrators. And so it makes sense that like a copy-paste version of one justice system isn't going to work for every single person. Even just the act of being like, survivors deserve more options around justice, to me is such a like, yeah, of course kind of thing. And yet I know that what I speak about is seen as very controversial, but I'm kind of like, I think we can all agree that there shouldn't be like a one size fits all approach.
Well, and that's the sense I got when we first talked, is that as you are describing this internally, I am prickling. And I have been taught through years of therapy that when you experience that prickle, it's just information. Like, stop and assess, why am I feeling that way? What's that bringing up in me? Because it's not about you or your experience. There's a lot of people who, you know, will attack online or, no, I'm going to get loud and make posters, whatever. What's that prickle telling you about yourself? And for me, it was that I'm having one of my core beliefs challenged here. All the things that I know, having gone through the criminal justice system as a survivor and as an employee, are being challenged here. And why does that bother me so much? And after you told me more about what went into your experience and why that felt like justice to you, I realized, because my experience, it would not work there. My offender does not take any accountability. He is creating multiple victims. There's no path forward for him to give me something that would make me feel restored. I would not feel a sense of justice even after all of my questions would have been answered. The only sense of justice I felt is removing him from hurting more people. And so it was one of those where I'm like, okay, I need to take this information in my reaction. We talk about this with triggers too. It's information, okay? We don't have to make it emotional, but we do have to think about it and work through it. And it's icky because it's like this internal battle with yourself. But on the opposite side, I'm like, okay, holy crap. Now I have a whole new viewpoint, a whole new expert to turn to when I have questions about it. And it's challenging something. It's a belief that I have held now for over 15 years. And I cannot thank you enough for that, because it's scary to be the only one standing there in a room full of prosecutors or law enforcement or these groups where they're like, RJ bad, me good.
Totally.
Let me tell you about it. It's not all feeling circles and talking sticks. It's legitimately centering the victim in a way that gets them the justice that they want.
Yes, exactly.
I feel like it's also empowering for victims, for prosecutors, for law enforcement to know that there is an alternative option. Because when you think about the burden of proof of proving someone guilty of a sexual assault, we know the statistics say that less than 2% of offenders will serve jail time. It's difficult to prosecute a sexual assault specifically. So having the option of something else that may be restorative for a victim, that's empowering to me. And I would hope that our listeners are, we have great listeners. So I know that you're all listening with open minds and allowing us to challenge you a little bit, but maybe this is something that you never even considered as an option for you. And if there are people who are listening and they're like, wow, I never even thought about this, and maybe it's not fresh, maybe, you know, it happened 5 years ago or 20 years ago, what would be your advice? What would you say to someone who thinks this might be something that would be restorative to me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for both of you for sharing. Also, Kim, for being vulnerable about that prickliness, because I think that's so real. And I think that's such a good perspective that it's information. So one thing I would say too is like, yeah, this isn't about closing any doors. If your court experience, Kim, and having this person put away was what you needed, good. Let's keep that door open. There's going to be other survivors who want that door. And we know, like, like you said, Kira, there are such high rates of acquittal, of like court cases leaning nowhere. There's also such high rates of underreporting. So people who aren't using the system at all. And when we look at like, why aren't they doing that? We see a lot of feeling like they won't be believed, feeling like they'll be blamed, feeling unsafe with the police, which is especially true for like queer, trans, Black, Indigenous survivors. And so opening more and more doors of like, here's what justice can look like, and here's something that feels accessible for every person in the room. I'm like, that's so important. I do think one of the reasons that some people will be like, we can't have this conversation, is because they feel like I'm saying we're shutting the door that's meaningful to you, and it's not that. So that's one thing. Another is, yeah, just that people deserve to take a moment to ask themselves what sort of justice would actually be meaningful to me. What are my needs? And that could be accountability. It could be reassurance they won't do this again. It could be asking the questions that they have. It could be wanting this person to change. It could be wanting the abuse to just stop. It could be all sorts of things. And then finding people who will support them in shaping a justice pathway around those needs. So that could be going through the criminal legal system and hoping for that support. But people can also contact restorative justice agencies, which are typically set up like nonprofit organizations. And there's trained professionals there and trauma-informed professionals who will help create those processes. And something that I'll add as well, because like I was saying, restorative justice can take so many different shapes based on what's accessible, based on what the people need. And if a survivor is like, this sounds really meaningful to me, but I know my assailant will never agree to it. I know they'll never take accountability. There is something called stand-in processes where they could have a restorative circle with someone else who caused similar harm and is taking accountability. I'll share a resource at the end, but there's a really great TED talk by Dr. Alyssa Ackerman, and she's a survivor, and she did one of these stand-in processes. So she met with a sexual offender who assaulted someone else. And the way she talks about that circle is very similar to how I talk about mine. It's like, this was life-changing. I let go of so much. And I think that option is so important for people to know, because I never want to imply like your healing is dependent on your assailant sitting in a circle. Like, no, it shouldn't be that way. So just knowing that all of these options exist and that you deserve to take up space with your needs and be like, this is what I need. I deserve to experience that. I deserve support around making it happen.
There's also different ways that it's now being integrated, or, you know, the thought process is there, not necessarily that the laws or the funding is backing it yet, but through the parole process. And there are different ways that you can implement restorative justice practices, whatever they may look like, at different points in that criminal justice system or afterwards too. The other thing to point out, when you have nonprofits that are working on these things, they can be the one that reaches out to the person who caused harm. It doesn't have to be you making that connection.
Oh yeah, that's a super important point, is like, that's what I said, like there's professionals. It was never me being like, hey, man who raped me, are you down to sit in a circle? Like, it wasn't that at all. And it should never be the burden of the survivor. So exactly, like there are mediators, there are therapists, there are trauma counselors, there are social workers, whoever, who are there to facilitate all of that communication and to make sure that it's like genuinely a trauma-informed process for survivors. And that's part of what blew my mind about this, was I was like, the process felt so caring. Like, it was so caring. They were like, what would make this room feel safe for you? What would be meaningful to you? What do you want us to take out of the room? Do you want to come a day early and see the room and you can like get familiar with it? What snacks do you want in the room? Like, it was so trauma-informed and humane. And unfortunately, that is such a contrast to the courtroom most of the time.
You'll learn, we don't really do segues, but I know that there was a contrast in the prosecutors that you worked with. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So when I first met with the prosecutors and asked for a restorative justice outcome, it very much was, I don't want to say the angel and the devil on your shoulder, because I don't want to demonize this prosecutor, but it very was like the two opposing things. So one of them, who I'm not allowed to name actually, so I don't know. I always find an object. I'm just like, I'll call her a cup because I'm holding a cup. But she was just really set on like criminal trial or nothing. Like it was this very deeply carceral conditioned thought process of rape equals bad, bad equals prison. I don't care what anyone else has to say. This is the way it should be. So when I first asked her about having this outcome, at first she was like, oh, I heard that you're a strong girl. Do you not think you're strong? And I was like, no, I think I'm strong. And she was like, great, so you can do the trial. And it was like this very coercive moment. And I talk about these things, I mean, same as both of you, in like a very grounded, cohesive way now, but that's not where I was at the time. Like I was still having trauma brain and freeze response. And I was kind of like, what's going on? And then I kind of like found myself and I was like, no, this is what I want. Like I want restorative justice. I want my assailant to go to therapy. I want this circle process. I don't want to do trial. And she thought I was, you know, ill in the brain. And she was like, oh, honey, like, don't you understand? Rape is bad. I was like, yeah, I understand rape is bad. And I think it's so bad. And rates have not declined in over 20 years. And so maybe we should be doing something different. And the last thing she said about it was, okay, fine. But with the Me Too movement, people really want to see rapists locked up. And I was like, I don't think the point of the Me Too movement is to silence the survivor's voice in the room. So it was kind of this back and forth thing. And eventually this other prosecutor who's named Kara actually kind of leaned forward and she was like, yeah, she's very cool. And she was like, listen, I've been a prosecutor for nearly 20 years and I constantly see victims re-traumatize, rapists almost always acquitted. And when they are convicted, they either serve a very short sentence and come out. And even if they serve a long one, they come out and they're more likely to be violent. So I agree, we need to do something different. I left the room that day and the two of them literally fought for the case for like months. And it was either going to be that cup got the case, in which if that happened, as she knew, I would drop the charges and nothing would happen at all. So she was really fighting for nothing in a sense. And then obviously if Kara got the case, we would have this restorative process and Kara fought for it. And so that's kind of why I emphasize the power of one person, just one person who has any sort of power in these systems to be like, hey, survivor, what do you need? Okay, that matters. Let's try and make that happen. Like that can be life-saving for people. So, you know, just the act of turning towards us and asking us those questions and really listening can be so, so huge. And I love her. I literally messaged her this morning. I was like, hey, Kara, how are you?
I love it. I'm writing that one down too.
Yeah. I think when Kim and I, when we do keynotes and when we talk to people about how to empower survivors, you've hit all of the nails on the head. It's just a little bit different way of thinking about things. It's listen to them, ask them what they freaking want, because everyone's going to want something different. And so I'm so glad that you had the experience where someone actually did listen. And I mean, I tell a similar story about opposing law enforcement officers that, you know, I interacted with. One treated me like shit, one treated me great, right? And the good news is that really, as a survivor, what I have found to be true is that often it takes one, like you said. It takes one person listening, one person wanting to do something, wanting to make a change. And it's great. It's fantastic if it's a prosecutor. It's fantastic if it's a sheriff. But it's also amazing if it's just a friend.
Totally. Yeah. And I feel like that, like with the friend who asked me what would actually be meaningful to you in terms of justice, none of this would have happened without her. Because it was like the first moment where I gave myself permission to be like, what do I actually want and need? It was such a like, hey, Marley, this is what the justice system is. You either fit yourself into that box or you don't. And having someone be like, no, no, what you need really matters. Like, tell me about it was, yeah, again, none of this would have happened without that. And I wouldn't have even tried to make it happen. So I'm 1,000% with you that that can make a world of difference.
It makes me so happy. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the things that you're doing now, because there's so many. I feel like you are just getting started, because even just in the little time that you and I have known each other, I'm watching this ball roll and pick up momentum, and I'm just so proud of you too. But tell us about what you're doing now and where you see this going.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I mean, it's funny because I shared my story with the media and then the pandemic hit. So it was kind of like this weird time warp, but then the pandemic ended and I was like, oh, I'm not just on Zoom calls. Like, I'm actually flying to different countries and sharing my story and speaking in front of judges and lawyers and military. And that was really the first thing that happened after I shared my story with the media, was that someone from the US military was like, we want to start a pilot program where we're trying different approaches to justice, because what we're doing isn't having much success. Like, can we chat with you? Can we learn from you? And I was like, what? I was like, I'm a little baby in Toronto in my like pajama pants, you know? And with time, I've just kept feeling the importance of this story. And what I mean by that is like how much bigger it is than myself. Like, it just is such a symbol of the very frequent failure of the criminal legal system right now. And it's like a hopeful pathway forward of like, what can we do with all this pain and trauma and devastation? And like, here's a story where it actually has somewhat of a happy ending. Obviously, I'm a human being living in a whole way, but like, that did have this happy ending. So it feels really nice to be able to share that. So for me, like, I just want to continue doing this speaking work. I was just able to speak in Belfast at a conference alongside the creators of internal family systems and polyvagal theory and all these things. And it was incredible. So that speaking work to me at campuses, for law enforcement, at conferences, I definitely want to keep doing that. Who knows academically if I jump back into that world of like social work and counseling and stuff. It could happen, but I'm also really focused on writing my book, Baby, right now. I'm working with like an amazing literary agent and just really loving like the power of story and reclaiming voice, which I've heard you both talk about, like taking our stories back and telling it in the way that's true to us. There's a documentary that was filmed about my story, and I don't know where it's at. I'm going to talk to the director tomorrow and be like, what's happening? But, you know, hopefully that will be out in the world soon. So yeah, I think just continuing to sort of like, it sounds a little bit religious-y or something, but just like, I feel like kind of in service to this story. And I'm just like, wow, this is really important for a lot of different reasons. And I want to keep sharing it until people are like, yeah, we already know about this. Because most of the time I get what you both responded with of like, I hadn't really heard about this or hadn't understood it in this context. So yeah, just going to keep sharing and awareness raising and educating.
Well, if survivors reclaiming their voices and using them for the power of good for others as a religion, sign me up.
Yes.
The one and only religion that Kim will sign up for.
That's going to be it. I will absolutely follow that. I will be sure to link all of these things in our show notes. We want to make sure that we are sending folks your way. She's just an incredible resource to those of you that are listening. And I love that you also share a very dark sense of humor. helps us along the way, because I like seeing, yes, the things that about the work that we do, but also the wonderfully dynamic people that we are. And they're so broadly different. Like you're talking about, survivors are not a monolith. And you get to see that through the things that you share on social media. And you're really fun to follow. And I highly suggest everyone go find her on these platforms. I will make sure to link all of those as well. I'm just so happy. And I am so excited to bring you back on someday to answer questions from folks, because I know that there's going to be a lot of them after this. If this is your first time hearing about restorative justice, welcome. It's a pretty cool concept, and you're learning from one of the very best.
Thank you. And definitely I'll send you the resource guide that I have as well, because anyone who's listened to this and either like wants to potentially access this for themselves or just continue learning and thinking about it, I have a whole resource guide that has documentaries, podcasts, global organizations, books, and all sorts of things. So people can find that at just marlylist.com/resource. And I'm always updating it as well. And the pretty amazing thing about this movement is that like people all over the world are holding this and doing this work. So no matter where you are in the world, there's probably someone near you who can support you in accessing this or learning more about it if you want to.
And then for our listeners, tell us where they can find you online.
Yeah. So if people just go on Instagram, and thank you, Kim, for hyping up my Instagram. I do have a lot of fun over there. I share a lot of resources on this. Also on reclaiming pleasure after trauma is something I talk about as well. And then just little personal life things. So yeah, you can find me at Marley List. It's just MarleyLiss. And then my website's the same thing, marleylist.com. Pretty easy to find. I dabble on TikTok, but it's not consistent, but you know,
it's a whole different beast over there.
No kidding.
I know.
I feel like if you have one that you're good at and you're enjoying, then just stick with it, because people definitely resonate. So, and I actually just started following you this week because I'm behind. on it. But I feel like for people who are just listening, I feel like I missed the pink memo. And I wish you guys would have told me, because I'm wearing gray.
Yeah, no, even if we would have told you pink, you're like, that's not my color wheel. Even though I absolutely love you.
I have pink shirts now. Thank you. You know, guess what? I'm going to Nashville after we leave here.
Ooh.
And I brought nails to put on. And guess what? 3 out of the 5 sets of nails I brought are pink. So
who are you?
Face.
It's very weird.
I'm a girl mom.
Well, Marley, thank you so much for joining us. This has been wonderful, and just so happy that you were here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored to share with you both. Like, you're both such, I feel like you're both like role models to me in terms of survivors making a huge impact. So thank you for all the work you do, and thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.